Here's a question that will tell you more about the health of your leadership team than maybe any other. When a conflict arises between what's best for your department and what's best for your organization, where does your loyalty go? Most leaders, I think if they're honest, they go to their department, not out of malice, but out of something that feels genuinely virtuous, a protective instinct toward the people on their team, the people they lead, a commitment to advocating for their department, their missional objective for their team. There's a sense of responsibility for the area that they've been given to steward, and that instinct feels like good leadership. It presents itself as loyalty. And it's quietly one of the most destructive forces in organizational life. Because if your primary loyalty belongs to the people that you lead rather than the team you lead with, you're not building a unified organization. You're presiding over a collection of competing fiefdoms, each one well-led in isolation, but collectively pulling the organization apart. And today we're talking about concepts that address this directly. And it will challenge some of your assumptions about loyalty and leadership and really where your primary responsibility is supposed to lie. And that's what we're discussing. And it's all right here, right now, and only on the Five Gifts podcast. You're listening to the Five Gifts podcast, a weekly show designed to equip leaders in the Spirit-filled church. I'm Bruce Ritter, and along with my co-host Charles Russell, we offer insights for leading the local church in the fullest expression of Jesus. If you're interested in learning more about practical theology, the gifts of the Spirit, and spiritual disciplines, this is the show for you. Welcome to the Five Gifts podcast. Welcome back to the Five Gifts podcast. I'm Bruce Ritter alongside the distinguished Charles Russell, and this is season 3, episode 18, and part 3 of our Team Dynamics series. It's great to be with you today. I've had a busy weekend, but I'm excited to be here with you. For us, it's a Monday, but you may be catching this at some other part of the week, either on our YouTube channel or one of your favorite podcast platforms. If you're on it, we're on it, and you can find us on any of those. Charles, what's happening in your world today?
Well, I'm like you. It's been a busy weekend, been a great weekend. Mother's Day was a great day of celebration, and so we celebrated all the moms and in our family, and there's a church. I'm working with a church right now who's preparing to eventually begin to look for a new senior pastor, and it's been exciting to watch their growth and watch them begin to come together. We did a big day yesterday on Mother's Day at this particular church, and it's been quite a few years, from what I understand, since they've really done a big push and kind of an outreach thing. And so we did that, and it was just wonderful to see the excitement in a full sanctuary, new families, new people there, and then after the day was over, just the excitement that just lingered there among the established folks of the people who just genuine excitement about what God's doing in them and among them. So it was a great day to celebrate in every regard. We just had a great weekend, and really what a great jump off to be here on this episode today of the Five Gifts podcast. You know, we've been building this series that we're in sequentially, and you know, the sequence it really matters. Episode 16, we established a foundation we called vulnerability-based trust. You know, that kind of relational safety that allows people to be honest rather than strategic in how they present themselves. Then the next episode, episode 17, we built on that foundation with the discipline of mining for conflict. In other words, why healthy teams require theological tension, how leaders create the conditions for it. And this was a great one. Why fighting fair is actually more efficient than artificial harmony.
Yeah, and today we're moving on to a concept that depends on everything we built so far, but it takes in a specific and an uncomfortable direction, and we're calling it the first team. You know, the first team is a simple idea to state, but it's difficult to live, and that's for really for any leadership team to function with genuine health and strategic coherence. Really, every leader on that team has to understand that their primary loyalty belongs not to the people they lead in their department, but to the people they lead with. And that usually is, you might think of it's the executive team or it's the lead team in the department. So we're going to cover what the first team is and why it matters and what the alternative will look like and what it's going to cost. We see some of the structural dynamics that either build or destroy organizational alignment and the specific practices that translate first team commitment from a concept really into an operative culture.
Well, let's start by naming the alternative to the first team clearly, because the alternative is not obvious dysfunction. It's really something that looks like, from the outside and often from the inside, it looks like genuinely good leadership. So we've got an instinct as leaders to protect the people that we're responsible for. To advocate for our team's resources, to shield them from organizational turbulence, to be in a sense kind of the apparent figure for the department that we lead. And none of that is inherently wrong. In fact, in the right measure, it really reflects genuine care, even responsible stewardship. The problem is when that instinct becomes the primary operating principle of a leader's identity. On a leadership team, when the unspoken question that's driving behavior in every meeting is not what is best for our organization, but rather is what is best for my people, then the leadership team stops functioning as a unified body and really becomes a collection of representatives instead, each one lobbying for their own constituency. And so the behavioral differences between these two orientations are really specific and very observable. A leader who's operating from departmental loyalty can treat their team as their primary home and identity, the place where their deepest relational investment lives. But a first team leader treats the leadership team as their primary identity and builds from there outwardly. So a departmental representative uses meetings as an opportunity to fight for resources for their area, even at the expense of what the broader, larger organization needs. But a first team leader is willing to advocate against their own area when the mission requires it. A silo builder avoids conflict with peers to protect the comfort and standing of their department. But a first team leader engages in direct, honest debate with peers because the quality of the organization's decisions matter more than keeping the peace. The question that really cuts to the center of this is one that every leader has to answer with genuine honesty. And here's the question. Who is your first team? Who are the people you lead or the people you lead with? Because the answer to that question determines everything about how you actually function in a leadership context. And it has consequences that truly reach far beyond the executive suite.
Charles, that's a good word. And I think of, in the local church, you have, let's say you have a youth ministry that is just going great guns, or a children's ministry that is really an attractive feature for young families in your community. It's possible, that the leader of that kids ministry or that youth ministry has things going so well, and so instead of leading comprehensively on the pastoral staff, working together as the team for the larger church, your interests begin to focus on your youth volunteers and what's happening only in that youth department, or your kids volunteers, and so real world examples are abounding in the local church, because the church should be built up of teams, and we really encourage team building in the local church. So I think what we're talking about, Charles, is really vital to how we look at this principle. We always need to make sure that we're not creating a culture of silos, but we're really building an integrated, strong, unified team that's working together. So, Charles, you talked about what the failure of the first team can look like. But let's look at what it looks like in practice and what it costs. I think it helps to have a concrete picture because the dynamics that we're describing, again, they're not abstract. They produce specific, observable, and deeply damaging patterns in any organization's life, the church, a marketplace organization. So let's talk about the representative versus the owner. Patrick Lencioni tells the story of a leadership team at a company called Decision Tech, and it's a billion-dollar opportunity that nearly collapsed, not because of market failure or strategic error, but because the people at the top were not functioning as a team. And the CFO was, by all measures, a phenomenal leader, detail-oriented and financially disciplined, fiercely protective of her staff. And on the surface, she looked like a model of loyalty, but in practice, you know, her primary loyalty was her department. And so whenever tension arose between what the executive team needed and what her people in her department needed, you know, she always chose her department. So in meetings, she was lobbying for her area's resources. And she confided in her direct reports about frustrations at the executive level. And of course, that creates a quiet us versus them mindset. That's a current that ran beneath the surface of the organization. And she avoided challenging her peers when it might cost her department standing. And that's what we call the representative mindset. That's the leader who comes to the executive table as an advocate for a constituency, in other words, her department, rather than the co-owner of the collective mission of the larger organization. And the contrast with the owner mindset is pretty stark. See, the owner is willing to sacrifice departmental budget or headcount when the mission requires it. Not casually, not without advocating for their team's needs, but with a genuine willingness to put the collective result above the departmental one. This is essential, Charles. It's so essential to be a truly missional organization. Now, this is where the owner maintains confidentiality about executive level tensions rather than seeding that downward into the organization. The owner is the one who holds peers accountable. They enter the discomfort of direct dialogue with a colleague about behavior that's damaging to the team. Why is that? It's because the collective goal matters more than the relational ease of letting it go. I like what Larry Osborne says about unity in a team leadership. He says it requires three things. It requires shared convictions, genuine respect and friendship, but also, and I think this is vital, a philosophical alignment. That's a shared way of thinking about what the organization is and how it should operate. And the representative mindset, that makes a philosophical alignment essentially impossible because the representative is not fully in. They're managing the relationship between two loyalties, and when those loyalties conflict, the organization always loses.
Yeah, and when that dynamic's present at the leadership level, when the people at the top are functioning as representatives rather than owners, then the consequences, they don't stay contained to the executive team. They travel downward through the organization with a compounding force. You know, we introduced what we call the vortex effect in our conversation about trust two episodes ago. And the way that, it really deals with the way small fractures at the leadership level become massive dysfunction at every level below. And so today, we want to go deeper into that specific mechanism that drives it. When a leadership team avoids the discomfort of genuine debate, you know, when they settle for what looks like agreement but is actually unaddressed tension, they leave the room with gaps in their alignment that none of them have fully acknowledged. Everyone thinks they understand what was decided, but the small differences in interpretation that went unaddressed in the meeting all of a sudden become significant discrepancies when managers and staff below them try to execute. When an executive team fails to achieve genuine buy-in from all members, even gaps that seem small at the top become irresolvable conflicts by the time they reach the people who are responsible for implementation. The staff who report to those executives, they run into each other trying to execute contradictory versions of the same directive. They experience the dysfunction as an organizational problem when it's actually a leadership team problem that is cascaded downward. This is what we call cascading ambiguity. It's one of the most common sources of mid-level organizational friction in churches and ministry organizations. The staff conflict feels like a personality problem or a departmental disagreement, but what's actually happening is the origin is a leadership team that never fully worked through its own misalignment. So now the unresolved conflict at the top becomes irresolvable discord in the middle. And the people caught in the middle have no capacity to fix it because the fix has to happen above them. And so the leader who avoids conflict with their peers to protect departmental peace really is not actually protecting anyone. They're passing the cost of their avoidance down to the people they were trying to shield and multiplying it in the process.
Yeah, so what we're talking about is a culture that is tying things up. It's creating what we might call under the surface issues that never get resolved. And so Charles, that just drains me. That's a culture that just makes me tired to even think about it as a leader. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what it actually takes to build the first team culture, because the concept is clear enough, but the structure that makes it real and sustainable, it requires some specific practices. Again, not just good intentions. So let's talk about the architecture of a healthy first team mindset. I think the foundation, as we've said throughout this series, is vulnerability-based trust. And it's worth reiterating here as to why it's a non-negotiable for everything else that's going to follow. Predictive trust or confidence in a colleague's reliability based on past performance is not sufficient for first team function. What's required is something deeper, and that's the confidence, I think, that your peers' intentions toward you and toward the organization are genuinely good. That when they challenge you, it's because they care about the outcome, not because they have a rivalry or they're trying to position against you. That when you admit a mistake or a gap in your own area, that honesty will not be stored and deployed against you later. And that's easier said than done. I think there's a learning curve in any organization, but you've got to be committed to it from the outset. Without that foundation, it's so vital. Without it, the entire structure is going to collapse, because the behaviors required of a first team leader, genuine ideological conflict, peer-to-peer accountability, a willingness to advocate against your own area, you know, those are only possible when there's enough relational safety to take those risks without experiencing them as existential or even personal threats. So from trust, the architecture builds a clear sequence. Trust is what makes genuine conflict possible. That's in all of Patrick Lencioni's writings. Trust is essential. The willingness to engage in honest, passionate debate about ideas without the debate becoming personal. Conflict is what makes real commitment possible, because people who actually have been hurt in a genuine process buy into the outcome even when they don't get their way. Again, weigh in to buy in is the principle here. People don't need to win the argument, but they need to know the argument was real. They need to know that they were heard. Commitment then makes accountability possible, because once a team is genuinely committed to a direction together, they have established the shared standard against which behavior can be measured. And accountability, when it's sustained over time, produces results. Not individual results, but collective ones that belong to the whole team. And then each layer depends on the one beneath it. You can't build accountability on a team that hasn't made genuine commitments. And you can't build commitment on a team that hasn't had genuine conflict. And you can't build genuine conflict on a team where trust is absent.
So we're just encouraging everybody to start a fist fight so that you can get that out of the way and then really begin to build trust. No, don't do that. Look, once that architecture's in place, there's a specific practice that makes the difference between a leadership team that's theoretically aligned and one that's operationally unified. It has to do with what happens in the final minutes of every meeting. And it's more consequential than most of us as leaders truly realize. One of the primary drivers of this cascading ambiguity we described earlier is the absence of a clear, shared narrative leaving the leadership meeting. Every person in the room heard the same conversation, but they're going to leave and they're going to communicate it differently, emphasizing different aspects, applying different interpretations, using different language. And by the time those variations reach the staff, they sound like different decisions rather than different descriptions of the same one. So the discipline that addresses this is what we call cascading messaging. It's not complicated, but it does require intentionality. It happens in about the final 10 minutes of every significant meeting. And it involves three pretty specific steps. First is explicit review. So before anyone leaves the room, the team stops and asks a single question. What did we actually decide here? Not what we discussed, not what we are still considering, but what was decided. And so this step really forces precision. It surfaces the gaps in assumed agreement before those gaps become organizational problems. And it ensures that every person leaving the room has agreed on the same specific outcomes. The second step is narrative discipline. So the team determines together exactly what will be communicated to the broader organization and what remains confidential at the leadership level. This is not about information control as a power move. It is about ensuring that your organizational voice is unified. When the message has been agreed upon together, it doesn't matter whether a staff member hears it from the executive pastor or from the worship director, because the message is the same. That consistency is what prevents the us versus them undercurrent that forms when staff begin to notice that what they heard from one leader doesn't quite match what they heard from another. Now, the third step is what we would call synchronized deployment. A commitment that the agreed upon message will be communicated within a defined window, typically 24 to around 48 hours. So staggered communication, even of accurate information, it can generate anxiety and speculation in the gap. But synchronized deployment closes that gap and it insulates the organization from the friction of inconsistent interpretation. Now look, these three steps they're not bureaucratic. They're the practical expression of first team commitment in the operational life of a leadership team.
Charles, those are fantastic. I think just to recap those steps again, the explicit review, the narrative discipline, the synchronized deployment, that's a great checklist at the end of any meeting. I think that's a phenomenal way of thinking about how we create the cascading messages or the cascading messages to our team. But in all of this, again, the trust, the conflict, the commitment, aligning the messaging, you know, really it depends ultimately on one capacity that is among the hardest to develop, and I think the most critical to sustain, and that's the willingness to hold our peers accountable. And that's where, you know, that's where any organization, that's where the rubber meets the road, because at the end of the day, I mean, you have to work with the people that you have. You have to be able to navigate those interpersonal dynamics and those relational tensions from time to time. So we might call this entering the danger zone, the peer-to-peer accountability. Really, in most organizations, accountability flows vertically. The leader is the source of discipline. And if someone's performance is slipping or their behavior is damaging to the team, it's the leader's job to address it. But when that is the only accountability mechanism available, the system has a significant bottleneck because the leader can't see everything, can't be in every conversation, it can't address every gap in real time. So in a first team, the primary mechanism is peer accountability, not the leader catching problems and correcting them, but colleagues holding one another to a standard the team has collectively committed to. And peer pressure is one of the, in the best sense of that phrase, is one of the most powerful motivators available to a high-functioning team. When a leader who deeply respects their colleagues and genuinely cares about their team's shared mission, then we find out we're not merely primarily motivated by policy or consequence. We're motivated by not wanting to let the people down that we respect and we value. But building peer accountability requires what we might call, again, entering the danger. It's that willingness to have the direct conversation with a colleague about behaviors or performances that's damaging to the team, even when the conversation can be uncomfortable. And you know, the truth is most leaders avoid this. I don't think the majority of people in leadership are just wired to go out searching for conflict. Most of us don't like the danger zone. And that avoidance feels like wisdom from time to time. I don't know about you, Charles, but when I've taken different DISC assessments, I remember taking one that was focused on conflict management. And I was so disappointed in the results that I was a conflict avoider. And then I think my adaptive style was just to accommodate. You know, every one of us in leadership have things in our own nature and our own personality we've got to overcome. Usually we adapt, I think, as leaders. And I know sometimes it's my nature to say, look, it's not my place, or I don't want to damage the relationship, or but the truth is avoidance is really not wisdom when it comes to your team dynamic, to getting the best performance. Conflict is absolutely necessary. And so we come down to the choice of personal comfort over organizational health. And when leaders consistently make that choice, the result is organizational politics. Man, that's a culture where people say what they think others want to hear rather than what they actually think, because no one has demonstrated that honesty is safe enough to practice. You know, we're not talking about a quick fix here. We're talking about a slow turn that's built on credibility and honest communication. So entering the danger means carrying the discomfort of a direct peer conversation rather than offloading it, rather than putting it off too long. It means trusting that the relationship is strong enough to hold the honesty, which is exactly why the trust we built in the first episode of the series, that's not optional. It really is the prerequisite for this kind of level of accountability to be possible.
Man, you've eloquently stated that, Bruce, about entering the danger zone. Said it very well. What truth it is. This is, I agree with it, probably the most difficult thing that we have to do. You know, you talked about those DISC profiles and assessments, and I was just thinking, in the DISC, from the way I've been trained, most of the population is would be classified as an S in the DISC profile, and or the largest percentage of our population. And those S's really have great gifts of nurture and of care, of teamwork, of connecting people together and helping people go together and journey together in business, in ministry, in the advancement of the organization. Just really, really gifted at keeping people connected and keeping people together. And so, you know, when we start talking about the danger zone and keeping people accountable, holding us personally, holding holding one another accountable. That can be really be a really intimidating proposition for a lot of people, because it's not a natural thing. But when we as leaders can lean into that and see that if we'll enter the danger zone, it lifts the organization. And it can become a real help. And, you know, you don't have to be a jerk about it. You don't have to be some arrogant know-it-all who it's my way or the highway. You know, there's a way to relationally to keep people accountable and to hold people to a standard that fulfills the vision, you know. And I think for someone who says, well, I'm an S, and I just can't do that, I think, no, you're absolutely gifted for that. You just got to look at how do I relationally, through the relationship, how do we keep one another accountable? And I think that's a beautiful picture and a very mm-hmm. effective way to still continue to keep them moving forward. It's going to require growth on that leader to step out of the comfort zone and enter the danger zone. But the risk is well worth the reward organizationally.
Yeah. Charles, if I could just give a point of, I think this is going to sound so simple, mm-hmm. But I found that one of the best ways to learn a new skill in leadership is to practice it. And yeah. So anytime I teach on coaching, well, there's going to do a few things that we do to practice. I want that group to practice. Number one, I want you to practice listening. And number two, I want you to practice asking good questions. Those are foundational for coaching, but mm-hmm. it's in the sense that they don't always come natural to us. Listening is a skill, and it takes intentionality. Asking questions rather than coming up with solutions and telling a person what the answer is. And I think when it comes to conflict, I would recommend that if you have difficulty in raising issues, difficulty in embracing conflict, look, get with a few trusted people and practice. Create scenarios where you can practice bringing up hard conversations and working on your phrasing and your wording so it doesn't come out personal. It comes out just in an objective way of looking at what's best for this organization. And I think if you'll practice it, and listen, practice with trusted people. Don't practice with people that already are suspicious or you don't have a great relationship with. Practice with people that can help you get better at it. So that's my 2 cents on that.
Those 2 cents are extremely valuable. What great value in that teaching you brought to us, Bruce. The other value that you brought out to us is you have inspired me to, when this episode's over, to go watch Top Gun, the movie. I'm going to enter in that highway into the danger zone. So anyway.
Cue the Kenny Loggins track. Bring it on, Kenny.
That's right. That's been playing in my head this whole segment. I can't get it out of my head. But hey, look, if this episode is challenging you and is helping you, please don't forget to like and to subscribe to our podcast. You can share it with your team and other leaders who are in your orbit. And so we really encourage you to like, share, subscribe, all the things. It really helps us, and we're trying to help people as best we can. So help us. Help as many as we can by sharing the episode. Well, as we continue with the Top Gun theme, as we try to start landing the plane here, terrible joke, terrible segue. That's why I get paid the big dollars around here. Just want to leave you with three questions, really as a practical audit for your own first team alignment. And I want you to answer them honestly, not aspirationally, all right? First of all, do you consistently prioritize the collective goals of your leadership team over the specific resource needs of your own department? Not occasionally, but consistently. When the two come into conflict, and they will, where does your default loyalty go? Second is this. Are you willing to enter the danger and hold a peer accountable for behavior that's damaging the team? Not just to think about it or mention it to the senior leader, but to really have the direct conversation yourself with the person who needs to hear it. And third is this. Does every significant meeting end with explicit agreement on what was decided and what gets communicated so that your staff never experiences the cascading ambiguity of inconsistent messaging from their leaders? Now look, these are not one-time commitments, okay? These are daily disciplines. Alignment is only as strong as the team's ongoing willingness to maintain it. And so that willingness is tested every time a meeting ends, every time a peer's behavior slips, every time departmental loyalty pulls against organizational mission. So just would encourage you to take some time and reflect on those three questions honestly and just kind of begin to see what surfaces as you reflect.
Yeah, Charles, I want to make sure that those three are in the description and in the podcast summary so people can go back and review those. Those are powerful questions. And I just want to say something to, you know, I know a lot of people that turn into our podcast are lead pastors, and maybe you just didn't recognize that one of the conflicts in your meetings with staff is the fact that they're really considering, you know, the priority of their team over the larger church. And maybe it's going to take some teaching on your part to make sure that everyone makes the shift. And so again, these are powerful questions. And I would really encourage you to go back, reflect on those. And remember, the health and unity of your leadership team is not one priority among many. It's the foundational priority. I would say, lead pastor, your relationship with your leadership team are the most important relationships that you're going to have in your organization. I know that sounds counterintuitive. I know you feel like the one that has to chaplain everybody and be everybody's pastor. And that's true. But don't forget that you're also a pastor to your leadership team. And you know, we consider one of the foundations of a real apostolic leadership is that you're pouring into those leaders and helping them develop. So really consider that. That might be a shift that needs to happen in your understanding. But again, learn to make that a foundational priority. If the foundation is fractured on your leadership team, that dysfunction is going to travel everywhere below it. So make the foundation healthy. That's going to create the conditions on which everything else in your organization can function from a place of health. So again, the work of building a first team, it's not a leadership development project running parallel to your real work. It is the real work. And it requires you to have the courage to go first, to be the first one to be vulnerable, to be the first one to demonstrate honesty and conflict, and the first to take on peer accountability when it comes to advocating against your own area when the mission requires it. So if you want to build that kind of culture in your leadership team, if you want coaching on what first team health can look like, look, connect with Charles, connect with me. You can reach us at charlesrusselltraining.com, charlesrussellministries.com, or coachingcardia.com. We love to work with leaders and leadership teams to help them build structural and relational foundations that really are sustainable ministry, that have those sustainable ministry effects. Next episode, we're going to continue this team dynamic series. We're going to move on to what it looks like when teams have built trust, learn to fight fair, and commit to first team loyalty. What does genuine collective accountability look like in practice, and how do you build a culture where it's normal rather than exceptional? And until then, we hope you have a blessed week. We'll see you next time, next week, on the Five Gifts podcast. You've been listening to the Five Gifts podcast. If you would like to take the next step as a spiritual leader, we invite you to visit either of our websites or contact us for leadership coaching. We can help you reach the next level in your own growth and leadership. We provide leadership, spiritual gift, and personality assessments that give you a better grasp of your leadership style, and we also create a customized growth plan that empowers you to reach your full kingdom potential. We can't wait to hear from you.